my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. His name is Chris. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Chris.
Display my Packer cup here proudly. There we go. My name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to any newcomers out there. There wasn't a lot that came up here to take a surrender chip or anything, but I want to welcome you if you are new. And welcome to those that are sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous, as I was at the tender age of 22. When I got here, it was 1981. It was a long time ago. I didn't get to stay right then. But anyway, I'm going to give you a little pitch. Yeah, I have to give a little pitch. My friends. My friends. Wow. An abridged version of what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. A lot of people share, they share about what it was like, but what it was like doesn't really matter, you know. I mean, it's what I was like when I drank, and that kind of matters to me, because that's how I identified my alcoholism when I got here the first time back in 1981, was a neat experience for me. I listened, which was a mistake. If you're here, you should tune me out right now. Just say, you know what, I'm not going to listen to that guy. I don't want to identify with him. So I was in the Navy rehab program. I wasn't a member. I wasn't a resident or a patient yet. But I was a staff member, and I always thought that was kind of a coincidence that the Navy would assign me a alcohol rehab service, you know, to work at. And I thought that was just a weird coincidence because I loved alcohol. I drank alcoholically from the get-go. And a lot of people like say, you know, when did you start drinking your first drink, all that stuff, you know, that doesn't really matter either, because I couldn't remember it if I tried. But my mom would tell me that when I was in the womb, she craved quarts of beer, quarts of Miller High Life beer. Back then, I knew a quart of beer was about a quarter or something, 1958. And smoked cigarettes. And I loved it. You know, as a little embryo in the womb, I'm like, yeah, Mom, way to go. You know, so I was the baby. I had an older brother at the time. And I was all right with being the baby. In fact, I liked being the baby in the family, you know. And then about 1960, my little brother was born. And he took my place as the baby of the family. And I didn't care much for him. But, you know, I did have to feed him. My mom would make me feed him. She must have known that I was, you know, a little, you know, ticked off about him taking my place. And, because I'm kind of king baby, is what Ole calls us sometimes. You know, if you go, if you want to whine to somebody, you should whine to my friend Ole, because he'll just say, yeah, you just want to be king baby, Chris. That's all it is, you know. So anyway, I identified with that baby part. So I'd have to feed my little brother. And I was maybe two, and, you know, he's just a baby, and I have his bottle, wow. I would be like, why is this taking so long? Hurry up! You know, like, come on, let's get this done. You know, so that's kind of the way I taught him how to drink. You know, like, get it done. Don't be pussyfooting around with the booze at all. Just make sure you drink it fast. And the older brother was really the smartest of the three Kately boys. We're all pretty smart. Almost too smart to get this simple program, you know. My older brother sobered up in 1987. I got a sobriety date in December of 87. He called me while I was in the middle of a pretty bad relapse at the time, and he was asking me, hey, what do I need to do to get sober? I'm like, Jesus, why are you asking me? You know, I mean, because he knew I was in AA before and stuff. But I was definitely not a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I'd never worked a step, had a sponsor. All I did was come to meetings because I like kind of fellowshipping with drunks. I really do. I like you guys in the bars. I like you guys out of the bars, you know. And if you really, you know, you've really arrived when you can hang out, you know, with drunks when you're sober. You know, because it is really hard to see yourself in action. You know, I mean, if you go to a bar, like I went to a dance one time, with my sister-in-law, and I think it was Little Charlie and the Nightcats, some kind of a boogie blues band going on there here in Visalia. And there was one guy out on the dance floor that was totally in a blackout, totally falling down, banging up against the wall, and he was just absolutely out of control. And I go, but for the grace of God, there go I. And that's exactly how I behaved when I got loaded. So, you know, a lot of people don't like to, you know, see themselves in other people. Like they use this term in Minnesota a lot is, hey, if you spot it, you got it. You know? And I would be like, I better not be spotting some intolerance here or some, you know, hatred there and stuff like that. I just can't, you know, live like that today. And my God doesn't allow me to live without a conscience today. I used to not have to worry too much about it because mostly I didn't remember, you know, the stuff that I did. People would report. They would say, Chris, do you know what you did last night? No, I don't want to know. You know, well, dude, you were like streaking down the street, you know, and this is the age of streaking, so I got to get naked and just go running, you know. Anyway, it's crazy. I would say by the time I was 16, I had an idea that I might have a problem with alcohol. And you know, there was some drugs involved there too, and the combination thereof, you know, I would strongly suggest that you never mix, you know, Valium and alcohol. Just don't do it. Bad idea. You'll fall down for sure. To keep from falling down, you know, what I would do when I had to pee, because it's hard to pee if you're laying on your back or whatever, you know. I'd be out in my friend's backyard, holding onto this tree limb like this, you know, holding on, just peeing, and up drives his father, you know, Gary Madden. And his father had just lost his wife, and my buddy had just lost his mom, and was, you know, died young from Hodgkin's disease, and it was really sad. So his dad was drinking quite a bit of Jay Bavay brandy and taking Valium. That's where we got this stuff from. You know, we just hit the old man for all of his stuff. And he said, he looked at me out there, you know, hanging onto that tree peeing, and he said, get that freaking drunk out of my yard. Get him out. You know, I don't want him anywhere in my house, in my backyard. I don't want him around. And he couldn't stand to see me in that condition, I guess. And his son soon became, you know, just as bad as I was, if not worse. And we gravitate towards people like us, you know, people that drink like us. People that don't drink like us don't understand us. You know, they really don't. They look at us and go, wow. I mean, if I look like that, I'd stop drinking. Jesus, that is really, you know, that is pretty freaking ugly what this guy is doing. And it was. It was really ugly. And I felt awful. And I hated me. So, Jesus, I don't know if I should. Well, Bill, my friend Bill McCauley, asked me to share about the time that I died and when they found out that I was still alive. It was very strange. You know, I finally sobered up in Hawaii for the last time, you know, on the 24th of February, 1988. But before that, I was bouncing in and out of AA. And this one time, I went out with some guys to a concert downtown Waikiki. And then they had, you know, Mai Tais in the lobby. You know, Mai Tais for like, I don't know, a couple bucks for a nice little mostly rum, you know, concoction that they call the Mai Tai. I didn't care what it was. I'm just drinking. And I'm drinking double-fisted. I'm buying two at a time. And I'm wasted. I just blacked out. And I lost all those people that I was with. My people. You know, my shipmates, my buddies are gone. Just disappeared. It's 12:30 at night, maybe turning about 1 o'clock in the morning. And you know, Waikiki's nice and everything, but nothing really good ever happens after midnight. You know, it just doesn't. After midnight, most people, you know, sane people are in bed, resting. You know, they've had dinner, maybe a couple drinks, went out dancing, went to a show, and they're gone. But if you're drunk like us, you know, we want more. More fun, you know, there's definitely more fun to be had out there, and screw you if you want to go home, go. So off they went. And I thought, what should I do? I got really nothing to do. I think I'll just take a swim in the ocean. You know, just take a little, I'll just do a little skinny dipping. You know, just take off all my clothes, all my possessions, everything, toss them on Queens Beach there and go for a little, backstroke or whatever I was doing. Bad. So I floated off into Never Never Land. And I think I remember kind of looking back at the shore thinking, that's a long way back. You know, I'm starting to really feel the booze now, you know. Ah, damn it, that's a long way back. But I don't know how I got back. I honestly don't. I don't know where I got back. I don't know how I got back. But I somehow got back. And I somehow gathered up a pair of Aloha shorts somewhere. I don't know. You know, just like no underwear or anything. Just these nice Aloha shorts. And I love those shorts. I don't think I have any more of those. But anyway, I lived in them back then. And I found my people. We're in, I think it's Mauna Loa Park down there. A lot of the park people hang out. And, some people call them homeless people, you know, winos, whatever you want to call them. You know, they were my people. And I loved them. But I was in the Navy. I had a job. I'm a normal person, man. Trust me. I mean, you know, I got my shit together, right? You know, I'm not a screw up like that. But there I was with nothing. And I'm like, hey, I know I had stuff when I got here. When I came downtown, I had a truck. I had truck keys. I had a wallet. I had IDs. I had all that stuff, you know. I mean, a shirt. And you know, all that shit was gone. And I'm going, what am I going to do, you know? I wasn't even really sure where my truck was parked. But these people, my people in the park were like, hey, somebody found a bunch of stuff on the beach and turned it into the police substation down there in Waikiki. Really? I said, I bet you that was my stuff. And they're like, probably, you know. Not everybody leaves their stuff sitting there on the beach, you know, and forgets or, you know, loses it or whatever. So I'm like, well, where do you suppose it is now then? Because I don't know where this substation is in, you know, Waikiki. Well, you should probably go downtown. Probably go to Honolulu downtown there, big city, go to the cop shop and check in with them. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know, that's a good idea. But I really wanted my wallet, my ID, and all that other stuff. I'm willing to go to any lengths for this stuff. And so I go down to the cop shop down there in the big city. And all I got, I had to scrounge the money to get bus fare to get there, you know. And plus, I think I needed about a quart of beer before I could stop shaking, at least. So I here I am, you know, with the winos. Who you say, man, can you spare some, got some spare change? I'm like, to the winos, I said, you guys got some spare change, man? I really need a drink right now. You understand. You understand how I feel. And they're like, yeah, we got you. So, they got me enough money to go downtown and, you know, enough for the drink. And I go downtown, and sure enough, all my stuff is there. My life starts to come all back together and stuff. I'm like, yeah, I got all my stuff. I'm all good to go now. I can go back. I need to go to work on Monday. I'm going to be sick. I'm going to be pretty sick. I'm going to be really sick. But, you know, I'll get through it. And I got to work, and they're like, it was before Monday. It was Sunday night because I was partying with some shipmates, some friends in base housing there. It was crazy, this kind of shit we used to pull on the base. But anyway, they're this family, you know, good people, and they're like, Chris, they reported you missing. They actually picked up your stuff, you know, the cops called the base and said that they had all your stuff, that it was found on the beach, and that you were missing, that you're dead. So when I walked into that little party that they were having that Sunday night in that house, they're like, there's a ghost, and Chris is missing, you know. And I was like, I just came back from the dead, you know. A lot of people go, it's a freaking zombie or something, you know. No, I felt like one. So that's my drunkalog there. I sobered up in Hawaii, which is really a great place to get sober. Paradise is absolutely wonderful. The Alcoholics Anonymous there, it's like they take you up under their wings. And they supported me until I could, had a solid foundation through sponsorship with a Marine staff sergeant. His name is Bill H. And That sponsor was so patient with me. I got him in 1987, 80, maybe the latter part of 86 and 87. And I was loaded, you know, right then thereafter. He just kind of watched me. He worked around the corner from me, and he watched me getting loaded and how I was, you know, coming into work, just a mess, you know. And, of course, there we had to, you know, on this base, this Marine Corps base, Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station, they like to PT a lot. They love to run around that base, you know, and they're like, come on, come on. And they like to bring their docs with them because I'm in a hospital corps, you know, so I'm in the Navy, but I'm with the Marines. And they would do it. We're having formation, like it's 6 o'clock, and we're all going to go on a nice little jog, you know. I was like, oh, God, it was just agony. But I was young, bulletproof, and, you know, I could do all that stuff back then. Not without a certain degree of, you know, pain. But later on, when I was done, when I had finally had my moment of clarity, I said, to myself, I can't do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. It's too painful. I've been to AA. I know how you guys live. I see the happy, smiling faces. I see these people, you know, that are free from the obsession to get loaded, which I was, you know, obsessed about. And they had something I wanted. They really did. There was, like, some really neat people in Alcoholics Anonymous back in Hawaii. Like Big Richard, you know. Big Richard was huge, huge Samoan guy. And they all talk pidgin, you know. It's kind of fun to, you know, learn that kind of dialect and stuff, especially if you're from Wisconsin. So I had a Wisconsin kind of style of pidgin. You know, anyway, talk when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So I finally hooked up with Bill, and we started working steps together. And this staff sergeant was such a geek that he wore, like, military issue glasses. You know, like, you know, they're just like, we call them birth control glasses because, like, any of the girls would be like, you know, stay away from that idiot nerd. You know, I don't know. He was different. This staff sergeant was definitely different. But what I liked about him was he was 6 years sober. He had a family, and he seemed like he was a straight-up guy. That he wasn't, and there was no bull crap in this guy at all. There wasn't anything that fake about this guy. He was, like, doing the deal for sure. And I wanted to get in his back pocket, and I did. I ended up getting in his car with him, going to his meetings, adopting his home group. And I heard home group today that jumped out to me really loud and clear about, you know, visitors saying, if you're a newcomer or a visitor from another group, let us know, you know, what group you're from and where you're visiting from. On that island, it was a must that you would in your opening pitch, when you identify yourself, that you identify yourself and your home group, you know. And I was a member of the Waimanalo, his home group, the sponsors, the Waimanalo Hang Loose group. You know, chaka chaka, we'd all go like that. And that group was Thursday night, and it was a madness there. It was just a lot of screaming and hollering, and just like what we did here tonight, a big line, a celebration of sobriety, of days and months, and, you know, and there was a panel up on the table, and you got 90 days, and it was like you got this diploma, you know. For me, it was a graduation certificate, you know, saying, you've done 90 days sober. You can now drink again. You know, yeah, all right. So I ended up getting that 90 days a couple of times at that home group, which later became my home group, because of the energy, because of the love. There was the diversity of people there. It was just unbelievable how many different types of people sober up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, all types of people from all walks of life. And I had to go. I mean, after I'd sobered up there, did the steps with my sponsor and everything, they came to me, and some crazy stuff was happening in my sobriety in Hawaii. You know, after I'd done the final detox, whatever, and everything else was going on, and they took all my discharge paperwork and threw it in the circular file, they let me stay, you know. They worked with me. They watched me grow in Alcoholics Anonymous over about a year and a half. And then they said, well, it's time for you to go. And I was like, well, you know, I only got 6 months left. 6 months left on my contract, you know, and I'm out. Thank God, you know, I'll be done with this stuff. And I've been serving now for 8 years. I'm through. I don't want to do it anymore. You guys really don't want me around anymore either, you know. And I got AA now. So I just plan on, I don't know, getting out here and staying in paradise. Because I didn't have a relationship yet with my brothers. I didn't have a relationship with my parents. You know, I was living on an island. I was like, that no man is an island. I was an island. I'd go home and touch base for a little while, but I could be me, you know, in Hawaii. So I never wanted to leave. But God had other plans. If you want to hear God chuckle, hear a little snicker from him every now and then, you just tell him your plan. You know, tell God your plan, and he'll just say, "Yes, Chris, I got something crazy in mind for you, brother." All right? So, because, I just wanted to, enjoy my single life and do what I did in Hawaii. I don't even remember. I don't think I had any relationships or anything going on back then. So I went to China Lake. Because they said, "No, we're getting you off the island. You're gonna have to go. We'll give you a choice. Three choices. All right, you can go to Yuma, Arizona, Marine Corps Air Station. No thanks. Okay, well, you can go to Barstow, Marine Weapons Depot, whatever. No thank you. What's the final choice? You can go to China Lake, California. China Lake sounds wonderful. Absolutely. What the heck's the, what the... What kind of port do they got there? What kind of ships are out there on that lake, No lakes. No lake. It's in the middle of the Mojave Desert, gateway to Death Valley. And my life truly began there at the High Desert Alano Club. And in the Navy, the Navy... The Navy's just too funny. I only had like 3 months to go, after I extended my contract to get this great duty station at, China Lake. Jesus. So, I was looking, now I'm on the mainland. Now I can go back home, fly back home, visit with that. And I'm getting so, I have sober friends at home now. I have relationships. My brothers have sobered up. And everything was kind of cool, And I ran into a lady that had at the time she had 3 years sober. So she was sober, I was sober about coming up a year and a half, 2 years. She's 3 years sober. And she was my travel agent. She arranged my travel. And I would tell her, I can get a better deal on the base. I just go to this place called, Sato or something like that. It was called SATO. It's a little travel agency, and they give you military discounts. My wife's like, "No, I can give you all that, and I'll give you more." I'm like, "Oh, I like more. More's good, So I started hooking up with her and doing meetings that she was doing. And she had a girlfriend named Valerie, and Valerie was hooking up with my sponsor named Roger. And we just had a great little, group there. And I married that gal in AA. We had the AA wedding at an AA member's house. And, I had an AA member spinning the little disco thing, and my parents came out. And I don't know, what year was that? 91, I think I got married. August. And 30th. No, anyway, it was a neat, neat day. Kimmy's dad was a three-tour Vietnam hospital corpsman, independent duty, incredible man, passed away a little while ago, about a year ago, and we're still going through stuff with that. And he gave us 10 years. He goes, I don't know if this is going to work. He goes, "I'll give them 10 years. They might make it 10 years, August of this year, we'll have 25 years together as the time goes by." And that's all due to you guys. If it wasn't for you guys, I would have left a long time ago. I would have checked out. I might even have checked out with her, because she checked out for about 8 years, and into a two bottle a day wino habit. She wasn't an alcoholic. She was a dope fiend, that kind of stuff. Whatever. She was crazy with the zoom zooms, but. You know, she liked to drink a lot too, and but she just couldn't identify with her alcohol as part of her addiction, so she was able to drink again, and that lasted for like 8 years, 2 bottles a day, 10 bottles a week, no, you know, weekends off, no holidays off, no daughter getting married off, none of that stuff, smashed for like 8 years, and yes, tough. But I had you guys to go through. You know, you guys were my out. I said, honey, sorry, gotta go. Got an AA meeting going to. You know, she's like, oh, you go then, you bastard, whatever. You know, go to your damn AA meeting, your damn group. She wasn't catching, you know, she didn't catch this fellowship stuff right away. I think a couple Richie Barnes dances, you know, kind of loosened her up for the big blow when she was done. But, yeah, she just celebrated 10 years on the 10th of February, 22nd of February. So. We have a little AA household now, it's just me and her. Kids, my daughter tried AA for a while and found out that, you know, it wasn't for her. And weirdest thing, she can like control her drinking, you know, like she stepped over to the nearest bar room, tried some controlled drinking, you know, tried to drink and stop and all that stuff. And she didn't get the bad case of the jitters. She was able to do that. God bless her. You know, I mean, she has a wonderful family. She's given me 3 grandchildren. And her husband is absolutely wonderful. He had a DUI once. I took him to an AA meeting. You know what? And it was one that I was the secretary, chairman, you know, all the other things. And I was, you know, it in Tulare AA, besides my sponsor back then was Ivan. He was truly Captain AA. But anyway, this is the old people I'm talking about. They're past now. And had in the big meeting up in the sky. And so there my son-in-law sits in one of our easy chairs in the Hillman House group meeting, which is absolutely fabulous Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, if you like small groups. Almost as nice as what you guys got it over there in the Pine. You know, I went to the Pine this weekend, and I always love going there because I really feel like that's the kind of AA that, you know, it started out as. That's the way AA began, you know, in those little living rooms and those little, you know, dining rooms at dining room tables, one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. Wow. So there's my son-in-law sitting in that chair just sawing logs. Yeah, through my whole meeting. I'm like, Jesus, this kid's never going to get it. And he ended up getting a job from my wife. And, you know, yeah, it was crazy. He got, you know, really a lot of nepotism going on. Isn't that what they call that when you hire your son-in-law and your family members? Because my wife's a manager. I wanted to say something about managers, too, you know, because I'm not a manager. I'm not a, you know, anything to do with management. I have one manager, that's God. And I love you managers that believe you can manage me. I mean, God bless you. I wouldn't want to manage me, you know. So, yeah, so there it is there. I mean, it's out, right flat out on the line. I have a manager. I have an employer. It's God as I understand it today. And, you know, I grew up cradle Catholic. By the time I was in second grade, you know, we used to have to walk by our church on the way to school, and on the way home, you'd have to check in at the church for catechism. I cannot tell you how many times I forgot to check in at the church on the way home. What? What? They have catechism today? Oh, I didn't know that, Ma. Sorry. Rarely would she turn me around and march me back, because then I'd be late, and I'd be like an embarrassment to the family or whatever. I didn't care. That's just the beginning of my skipping days, of skipping places that I should be, you know, I'm supposed to be, for places that I shouldn't be, doing things I shouldn't be doing. And there's a price to pay for that, too, you know. There was a price I paid for doing stuff I shouldn't be doing and not being where I'm supposed to be. I think it's got something to do with being called, like, having some character, like reliability, you know, dependability, any of those kind of character assets. I lack that. And yet, when I was applying for jobs, I dropped off a resume at one of these places, and one place told me, well, why don't you come back and fill out an application? Oh, sure, I'll be back. I'll fill out an application. No. I don't want to work there. So the next place calls me, and they're like, oh, boy, why don't you come by and fill out an application? I'm like, yeah, I will. And I went by there, you know, filled out this lengthy application. I can't tell you how long it takes, you know, a 57-year-old guy, you know, to fill out an application of all the places that he's been working since he retired in 2010. You know, I mean, I just was like working in wherever God has me work. You know, I'm his doggone employee. Contrary to my wife's pop, you know, her opinion. It doesn't matter, but I love my wife. Anyway, yeah, I know. God bless her. So, I put down as references my sponsor. Who else would you put down on there as your reference? You know, your sponsor, he knows you, right? And she called him. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, geez, I can't believe you called Grass, you know? And then, I think that's the only person she called. And she asked him, she goes, is he reliable? Is he dependable? Oh, yeah, he's reliable. He's dependable. Now I got his name riding on the line. You know, now it's not just me. Now I got his name and maybe all of your guys' names too, you know. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hold myself to a different kind of a standard now than I did when I was a member of the drinking community. You know how the drinking community is. We come up with some whoppers, you know, some serious, you know, non-truths about, you know, what happened. And a lot of times, we didn't know. You know, to my defense, I did not know. So I'd come up with something like, yeah, you wouldn't believe what happened last night, you know. Oh, my poor grandma, you know. My grandma, you know, died, I don't know, it might have been the sixth or seventh time this time, you know. I was like, I just can't show up for work now, you know. And I can do that in sobriety, too. I had a guy, I was sponsoring, I really loved him a lot. He's a neat guy. Salesman type, you know, the guy with the gift of gab. He could just talk and talk. So I admired that about him. And he had a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, like bass boat. He lived in a gated community. He didn't have to work, you know. He worked because he liked to work, and he made a lot of money. And he was a Rosie's liquor store frequenter, you know. He lived out there by Lover's Lane, I guess, and across the street that way, and drove a Volvo, and you know, had a beautiful wife, three kids, and he came into AA, and he hooked up with me as a sponsor, and then he got into church, and he hooked up with Jesus, and the light came on, and he's like, man, this is it, I got it, I figured it out, I know the meaning of life now, it's not about, you know, me, it's about, you know, having a little God consciousness in my life, being aware that God's in charge, and, so that light switch must have went off about a month later, and he went and stopped by Rosie's, and he picked up a bottle and went for a drive up into the mountains to do some meditating and some praying while he was getting hammered, you know, I mean, by himself. And it wasn't enough. He came back down the mountain, and now he's kind of, you know, he's got one bottle down, and he's a little bit, you know, shaky on the road. And he gets to Rosie's, gets the second bottle, and starts heading back up to the mountains again. And I guess he made it up to the mountains, right? So he was good there, drank that second bottle, came home. Now he's really messed up on the freeway. And I got all this from his wife. She was a good Al-Anon member, too. And she said he got pulled over. You know, somebody called him in, called 911. There's a drunk on the road. So somebody pull this guy over. Jesus, you know, it's going to kill somebody. And they pulled him over in his Volvo, and he had a gun in the glove compartment. I don't know, you know, he's just nutty, whatever. He thought about that gun in the glove compartment and thought about that cop coming to arrest him for a DUI, and he was going to look in that glove compartment and see that he had an unregistered weapon, and that he was going to go do some time behind all this. And he just wasn't able to do time. So he pulls the gun out and just shoots himself in the head right there as the cops come to arrest him for DUI. And I'm sure that he was not in his right mind when he did that. I'm sure that he was blacked out, that he was absolutely, you know, insane. So that was devastating to me. That was a devastating blow, you know, to lose a sponsee like that. And she called where I worked. She called Avenal. I was working in the prisons at the time. And she says, hey, so-and-so died. And I was like, what? Oh, yeah. You can come and get your books and stuff now. You can come back, come over to the house and pick up all your books and all that stuff. You know, all this stuff that I've given him. And I'm like, I do not want to go see her. You know, I'd taken her to Al-Anon and said, this is what, you know, this is how you can deal with this drunk, you know. And I don't know. It was real painful for her. But she was able to, you know, just say, hey, you know what? I still have to live for my kids. I got to live for my kids. So she was able to take her 12-step recovery program, the Al-Anon program, and go down to Valencia or something like that, or what's that one that by the beach? I can't think of it now. Venice, something like that, I think. And I haven't heard from her since. That's been quite a few years back. I think that was about the time that the towers went down. So. Yeah, my life has been amazing since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and surrendering this time. My younger brother was so important that he sobered up, you know, because he was such a bad. He hurried up with that bottle way too much, you know, and he was a falling down, tongue chewing, you know, babbling idiot, drunk, and his wife loved him that way, just absolutely loved him that way because she was in control. She had everything, you know. She was like, I got this, you know. I got the purse strings. I'll work this guy. And she did. And they, you know, when he sobered up, she didn't like that much. They stayed together for about a year after he sobered up. And then she broke away from it. And this lady in AA, I think she's got, like, my sister-in-law has 35 years sober, something like that. And so at the time that she got together with my younger brother, who was just, you know, a little over a year sober, she's like, you know what? I want to have your babies. So I was like, wow, yeah, let's go make some babies, honey. You know, great. Well, the thing was is that she couldn't make any babies. You know, her fallopian tubes were all trashed and whatnot, and so she had to have in vitro. Well, I'm sorry, I don't want to get too much detail about that. You know, there's stuff that causes that. I don't know. It's probably just, you don't want to know. But anyway, she ended up having to have these babies with in vitro, and, you know, and they paid good money to implant these embryos, and then they had to do like a lay on your back for 9 months, purse string, her cervix was messing up, and all this other stuff was all crazy, and they're like, she's not going to be able to have Kevin's babies, you know, and she lost one out of the three embryos and had the two boys, and those Kaylee boys now just recently turned like 15, so wow. You know, I see them on Facebook. That's how the only place I can see these Kaylee boys, and they grow up so fast, and they have, you know, a sober mom and dad and they have a way to live. They have a design, as my friend Pat likes to say. They have a design for living that works, like a blueprint, some guidepost. You know, I had none of that when I got here. I think the Catholic Church is trying to give me some of that, but I was like, yeah, thanks, but no, you know. I got my own. I'm dancing to my own drummer, my own tune, and I had to give that up too. That's, I guess, what I want to share before I close. It's already 5 till, so I went on way too long. Other than I love you all dearly, and I'm grateful to be able to report to you that, you know, 28 years later, I still am very enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and sponsoring and being sponsored and having fun while I'm sober. So much fun, I can hardly stand it. And, you know, and planning for fun and all that stuff. So I guess what I have to say is I could report, you know, like there's a story I heard recently on one of the speakers that I listened to on the YouTube. And this guy's name is Sean A. He's Irish Catholic, you know, and all that stuff. And he's talking a story about, you know, John the Baptist. And John, you know, he kind of handed over the reins to Jesus and said, hey, you know what, Jesus, you got this. You know, you're much more powerful than I am. You know, you're the Son of God. Go ahead and, you know, have at it. Go out there and save humanity. You know, save them from themselves. And And report back to me. Let me know how that's working, you know, because I'm probably going to be locked up in jail, you know, hair is getting ready to whack my head off. I just want to see what's going on out there in the world. So, the disciples went back to tell John, you know, what Jesus was doing, what Jesus had been up to. And they said, hey, you know what, John, the blind see, the deaf hear, and the lame are taking up their beds and they're walking. And it's all working just fine out there. And it's because, you know, you gave up control and let somebody, you know, somebody else run with the ball for a little while. So I'm reporting that after being here for 28 years, I sponsor people so that they can pick up the ball and report back to me on how's it working out there, you know, who's getting it and who isn't, you know, and what can we do to help that guy that isn't getting it. God, I'm so grateful for all of you, and I was so grateful that I was, you know, trying to go to the bathroom in the women's bathroom over there, and I ran into Misty, and Misty's like, don't you remember me? Like, I was, you know, 10 years ago, whatever, I was in it, I met you, and I remember you, and I'm like, oh, wow, I definitely remember your face and stuff. She just goes, and I'm like, I don't know, she said, I'm 30 days sober or something like that. I was like, wow, that is awesome. So, whatever, keep coming back. No matter what, don't ever let anybody take your seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's yours. You have paid for it through the sweat and blood and tears of your own experience. And you don't ever have to give it up for anybody. And the only person that can keep you from coming here is you. You know, I mean, if I'm coming into a meeting like this and it's like, oh my God, it's 7:30 and it started at 7 and oh, screw it, I better not go in. It's going to be full. There's not going to be a seat for me. Oh, what am I going to do? I just go in. And you know what? I had Mark G was over here running the show a while ago, this monkey show here, and he's like, hey, and he goes, come here, Chris. He said, pulls out a chair out of his closet. Eventually, outside, out of his ass, but no, he pulled it out of the closet back there and said, sit down. You know, here's your chair. Because we earned our chair here, and with that, I'll shut up. Thank you all for being here for me.